The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Tiana Toiono.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Immigration. How many people have been deported by Immigration New Zealand since the beginning of March 2020, and of these, how many have been deported to Pacific Island nations?
The Honourable David Parker.
On behalf of the Minister of Immigration, I'm advised that the total number of people liable for deportation who were deported by Immigration New Zealand from March 2020, including those who self-deported, or in other words departed voluntarily following compliance action, is 1,088. Of this group of 1,088, 119 people were returned to the Pacific. Deportations to the Pacific are fewer when compared with pre-COVID because of both border restrictions and limitations on available flights. The deportees this year included people who had completed prison sentences for convictions of violence such as assault, serious assaults, threats and intimidation. Where deportations occur, Immigration New Zealand works closely with Pacific governments on management of that process.
Supplementary question. Does he share the concerns of the Pacific Leadership Forum that fear and anxiety about deportations is a barrier for Pacifica overstayers being tested and vaccinated, and that this could undermine the government's COVID response?
Look, I think the government's been absolutely clear that we're not approaching deportations in that manner, and that we're doing our utmost to include everyone in the vaccinations that we need every New Zealander to take. These deportations are of a different category. And I would also note that in respect of Fiji, which of course has had COVID problems develop this year, there has been no deportations at all since the 22nd of April this year.
Does he think that deporting overstayers in the middle of a pandemic sends a message of fear to a community that is being encouraged to come forward to get tested or vaccinated?
Well, as I said in response to an earlier question, I think we've made it abundantly clear that vaccinations are not being used to identify overstayers, and that the deportations that we have seen earlier in the pandemic were of a different nature. And as I also said another answer, for example, in Fiji there has not been one deportation even for released criminals since the 22nd of April this year.
Supplementary, is the Minister confident that people being deported have been tested for COVID-19 to minimise the risk of unknowingly spreading COVID to Pacific countries?
I can't answer for every person, partly because a lot of the deportations that there have been are voluntary departures by people whose visas have expired. In respect of people who have come from the correction system, you will have heard from answers that the Minister of Corrections has given to this House that there are considerable steps undertaken within the correction system to ensure that everyone there is safe and free of COVID.
Does he consider that a decision on an amnesty for overstayers as a part of a public health response should be made now rather than at the end of the year through the immigration review?
No.
Supplementary, is the Minister confident that Immigration New Zealand conducts investigations into potential migrant exploitation before deporting overstayers?
Could I ask the member to repeat that question? I'm not sure I caught the import of it.
Is the Minister confident that Immigration New Zealand conducts investigations into potential migrant exploitation before deporting overstayers?
I don't have detailed information on that. I do have confidence in the department, but if the member wants to put down a question in writing to the Minister of Immigration, I'm sure he would be happy to reply.
Question number two, Andrew Warren Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for COVID-19 Response and asks, what recent progress has been made on New Zealand's COVID-19 vaccine program?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand is successfully rolling out at pace the largest immunisation program the country has ever seen. Nationwide, three quarters of the eligible population aged 12 plus have now received their first dose, and 40% have received their second dose, meaning that they are fully vaccinated. 53% of Māori have had their first dose, with 26% getting their second. For Pacifica, the vaccination rates are 68% for the first dose and 36% for the second. In terms of our over 65 population, 91% have received at least their first dose and 80% their second. For those aged between 40 and 64, 80% have had their first dose and 44% their second.
Supplementary. How is the vaccine program specifically progressing in Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, a phenomenal effort's been undertaken by the people of Auckland over the last 6 weeks, seeing them leap to the front of the pack with the highest vaccination rates of any region in the country. To date, 1,740,608 doses have been administered in Auckland. 1,134,586 people have had their first dose, allowing them to hit the 80% mark in terms of first doses. 606,000 of them have received both doses and are therefore fully vaccinated. I want to pass on my thanks to all those who have been involved in this effort, all those who have already been vaccinated. This is a mammoth operation and they deserve full credit.
Supplementary. What innovative steps are being taken to help increase vaccine numbers in Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, just this morning I met with vaccination providers and the DHBs in Auckland to discuss the ongoing rollout of the campaign. Auckland have introduced, of course, the now famous ShotBro buses, which are being targeted specifically to locations where people are currently gathered under Level 3 restrictions. The buses are focused on reaching communities less inclined to be actively engaged with the health system. It is a really good example of taking the vaccine directly to the people. And today these buses are out back on the roads in South West and East Auckland. I was able to speak with them, with a number of people involved in that earlier today, where they are considering other similar and novel approaches to increase vaccine uptake. And I'll be having similar conversations with other DHBs and providers throughout the rest of this week.
Question number three, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. In particular, I stand by the government's decision to increase funding to Māori health providers to provide ongoing support to Māori communities while responding to COVID-19. We know we all need to do all we can to ensure no one is left behind in our response to COVID-19, and that includes in our vaccination program. Working with Māori and Pacific providers on our COVID response is part of that strategy.
Why were protocols not in place to prevent a COVID-positive gang member being remanded to an address outside of Auckland, despite the government having 18 months to plan for regional lockdowns?
Mr. Speaker, I refute the premise of that member's question.
Why are New Zealanders still not able to show digital proof that they've been vaccinated when most other countries have had this system in place for months?
Mr. Speaker, I'd point the member to the fact that most of those countries who have those digital tools have also been using them as certificates for entry to different sites and so on. Of course, we are not in that position currently. We do have an ability for people to access a demonstration, a certificate of sorts, that they have been vaccinated. People have been doing that through the Ministry of Health. And as I've said in this House before, we're currently working on a digital model that will allow people to be able to carry that information, certification with them, and we expect that to be completed shortly.
So did the Prime Minister say just recently, just today, that she refutes the allegation that a COVID-positive gang member was remanded to address outside of Auckland, in which case, how does she refute that?
I refute, Mr. Speaker, that there weren't protocols in place.
Then why weren't they followed?
Mr. Speaker, an individual is able to be bailed to an address outside a level four, as it were, environment. The issue was around the way that person was potentially transported or came into contact with COVID in the future.
Has she received a report that an additional 8 Middlemore staff have been stood down after gang members connected to the mongrel mob cluster, who should have been self-isolating, visited an associate on Tuesday evening in the hospital?
Mr. Speaker, whilst I don't have the individual affiliation of individual contacts. The member will be aware that there was an individual who was a close contact who did seek to visit another contact. That individual, yes, was meant to be self-isolating. I am advised that that individual has tested negative, but of course is still obliged to continue to follow the public health rules as we do for all contacts.
What processes are in place to protect the staff of Middlemore Hospital from situations like this continuing to occur?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's unfair to state continuing to occur as if somehow all 30,000 individuals who have been covered by requirements under our COVID response have somehow acted in this way. They have not. We have here an incident that has occurred where security personnel were involved because they are close contact. They've been treated as contacts as a result of this incident. Of course, we want to maintain security to keep our professionals safe. And in this scenario, some of those individuals who have come in contact, there are protocols being followed to ensure their ongoing safety from COVID-19.
So why are gang members being allowed to break lockdown rules, breach their isolation orders and spread COVID? And what action does she tend to take to stop this continuing?
Mr. Speaker, it is simply wrong to imply that we have an environment where everyone is just able to do whatever they want. Of course they haven't. Broadly speaking, we have had excellent compliance. We unfortunately have had some examples where there have been issues with compliance, but I would put the emphasis on some examples. The member has relayed one. We've had others that relate to our border breaches that we've seen that have cut across all walks of life. COVID affects everybody. Our job collectively is to make sure that we have rules in place to keep people safe, to do what we can to enforce those rules, and to act when those rules are broken. But the member making assertions as if somehow every single contact has behaved in this way is just wrong.
Question number four, Tangi Pitikeri.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Local Government. What steps has the government taken to ensure that the Three Waters reform proposals are well understood by councils?
The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr. Speaker, right from the beginning I've worked closely with local government. We've established a steering group with LGNZ and Taitūra and a subsequent technical working group to address specific areas of the work program. Prior to the local government conference, the government released detailed information on the case for change, the reform objectives and proposed design features. The government and LGNZ technical advisers have provided councils with a variety of tools to help them understand their individual positions with and without reform. Officials from DIA and members from LGNZ and Taitūra have undertaken an extensive period of engagement with local government during August and September to ensure the reform proposals and the impact on councils and ratepayers are well understood. LGNZ and officials are continuing to hold one-on-one discussions with councils at their request, as we would expect.
Supplementary, what feedback has she received from councils in relation to the proposed changes?
Mr. Speaker, at the request of LGNZ, the government entered into an 8-week period over August and September to enable councils time to consider the reform proposals, understand the implications for their communities and provide feedback on those proposals. I thank councils who have engaged and provided feedback. I'm hearing some clear themes that include consideration of how the entity governance, planning interface and iwi and community input will be achieved in the new system and how they might be strengthened according to local preferences. I'm committed to working in partnership with local government, iwi and Māori throughout the reform journey and have indicated that right from the beginning. I'm also aware that there's some public discussion about the government's modelling, in particular that undertaken by the Water Industry Commission for Scotland using data provided by each council. This government has confidence in the modelling undertaken for us by a reputable international expert organisation. It's been independently assessed and proven to be robust.
Supplementary. What does she say in response to suggestions that pausing the reform will help the challenges faced by councils?
Mr. Speaker, pausing the reform discussion will not help to respond to the significant challenges facing councils. Many of New Zealand's communities are dealing with rising costs and unacceptable outcomes from their three water services. That's not good for the health of people or the environment. The case for changes is strong, well canvassed, generally accepted by most. These challenges have been discussed for more than two decades, and it's time to do something about them.
With regards to the issues raised by councils, is there room to consider their concerns within the context of the proposed reforms?
Mr. Speaker, we've given councils 8 weeks until the 1st of October to provide feedback on the water reform proposals. As I've already noted, prior work and feedback through this period has identified potential refinements to the current policy design. I'm willing to work in partnership with local government and iwi to ensure the reforms meet the needs of communities. That's very important. We've already considered and ruled out alternatives to reform, such as regulation-only models and further central government funding of local government infrastructure for an inefficient network. There are inherent challenges that create a cost burden either way on ratepayers or taxpayers. Our reforms, the ones that I'm proposing, are designed to improve public health and environmental outcomes, improve efficiency of service delivery, support a financially sustainable system, improve infrastructure delivery and decision making while upholding the rights and interests of my iwi through Te Mana o Te Wai.
Commentary.
Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Is the Minister still actively considering making it mandatory for councils to become part of the four regional water entities if too many councils decide to opt out? If so, why?
Thank you for the question. As I've said, the case for change is compelling, well understood, and needs to be addressed. We've undertaken about 30 different sets of modelling to see whether or not there is any significant alternative that would enable a financially sustainable model to invest in the significant costs facing councils. The issue is now for councils to consider the proposal in a way that they will continue to own the assets, albeit within the reform that's being proposed, and have greater oversight in the way in which efficient governance of those assets can deliver community benefits. That is the proposal in front of councils. We have shifted significantly the discussion into a space where I believe even councils cannot ignore the opportunity they have ahead of them.
Question number five, Brooke Van Velden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Broadcasting and Media. Does he stand by his statement, quote, "We are constantly reviewing our safeguards to ensure we have the right tools to respond to potential issues of foreign interference," end quote, in relation to reports over Sky Kiwi's terms of service?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes.
Supplementary. When was he first made aware that a leading New Zealand news outlet, Sky Kiwi, warned its users their information could be shared with relevant state agencies if they violate Chinese law? And does he believe Sky Kiwi's terms of service are an infringement of standards expected by media?
Mr. Speaker, I became aware of the situation the member describes in an online article in the last 2 weeks, and I simply point out to that member that the law in New Zealand covering New Zealand citizens and residents is the law of New Zealand, and laws from other sovereign countries are not enforceable in New Zealand.
Supplementary. Does he believe that New Zealanders of Chinese origin are exposed to Chinese state surveillance and censorship by Sky Kiwi? And if so, what is he doing to protect freedom of speech on media platforms?
Mr. Speaker, I think it is a stretch to say that purported conditions of use or participation on an online platform constitutes external surveillance by a different sovereign state. New Zealanders participating in any form of media in New Zealand have the benefit of our laws, including our New Zealand Bill of Rights Act and the confirmed freedoms of speech and expression. And for news media outlets who are covered by, for example, the Media Council, which Sky Kiwi is, They have the benefit of the principles and values and rules of that organisation and methods of recourse if a user considers those rules have been breached.
Supplementary. Will his inquiry ensure that we can stop Chinese Communist Party interference of New Zealand media to the extent where media outlets feel obliged to share New Zealanders' data with the Chinese Communist Party?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not quite sure what inquiry the member is referring to, but what I can say is that there is a review of content of media content regulation underway that will also include what the likes of the Media Council and the Broadcasting Standards Authority do to ensure that the organisations under their remit comply with the standards that those organisations stand for.
Supplementary. Does he believe New Zealanders of Chinese origin have the same rights to be free from foreign interference and freedom of association as all New Zealanders?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the people who that member refers to whilst in New Zealand are covered by New Zealand laws and rules and norms, and that includes our New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, which confirms and upholds the rights of freedom of expression and freedom of speech.
Question number six. The Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Finance, is he concerned with the report from the Restaurant Association who have said 1,000 of their members are on the brink of closure without additional support? If so, what additional targeted action will his government take to save these businesses in the hospitality, retail and event sectors?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
The loss of businesses and jobs anywhere in the economy amid the uncertainty created by COVID-19 is concerning. That's why the government has responded quickly and decisively to put in place support, such as the wage subsidy scheme, to help firms keep operating and help keep people connected to their jobs. In answer to the second part of the question, as we have done continually through this pandemic, we will update and expand our support to businesses and workers to ensure it is adequate. During this latest outbreak, we've expanded the coverage of the resurgence support payment to include new businesses, as well as modified it into a three-weekly payment to recognise the extended period of alert level restrictions. The way that these supports are structured, including criteria around revenue drops, act as a de facto targeting to sectors such as those mentioned in the member's question in terms of the support that they have received.
Thank you. Why has the wage subsidy not been paid to 37,000 businesses who have waited 5 weeks? And is he aware of the significant financial and mental distress this is causing?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not 100% sure how that relates to the primary question that the member's asked, but as the member is well aware, we've traversed this matter in the House before. In large part, this is a data matching exercise between the Inland Revenue and the Ministry of Social Development, in particular for those who are sole traders whose tax code with Inland Revenue does not indicate that they are sole traders. The member and his party have been very keen to make sure that the wage subsidy scheme has integrity measures built into it. This is one of those integrity measures. I have been raising consistently with the Ministry of Social Development and Inland Revenue my desire to see these resolved quickly. I would note, Mr. Speaker, that 91% of applications are being processed within the three-day period indicated.
Is it correct that the government was asked on the 9th of June by the events sector for assistance with an insurance scheme that would have paid $20 million to its members if New Zealand was placed into COVID level 4, and that his government has said no to this help?
Mr. Speaker, again, I'm asking really whether or not that is relevant to the primary question, but Mr. Speaker, we've had ongoing discussions with the event sector going back all the way through to last year. There have been calls for a number of different types of underwriting schemes. At this stage, the government has decided not to go down that path because clearly it would be an enormous precedent-setting exercise. I do know that some local councils have taken that on. I would also note that the government has provided significant assistance to the event sector via, for example, the $50 million fund that's gone to regional tourism operations to put on events, and we continue to work with the sector to see how else we can support them.
Just before I ask Mr. McLay to ask his next supplementary, I want to make it clear to the Minister of Finance that judgments as to relevance of questions are mine and not his, and his asides are not helpful. In the latest case, he is plainly wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, is it fair that businesses currently in Level 2 can still apply for the wage subsidy, but that Auckland businesses will not be eligible when they go to Level 2, even though their need is perhaps greater? And will he change this policy setting for Auckland?
Mr Speaker, the wage subsidy scheme has always been related to Levels 3 and 4, where there are a significant number of businesses who either cannot trade or trade significantly below where they would normally want to do. The government has put in place the resurgence support payment that is available at Level 2 or above to support businesses with fixed costs that are more in line with what the restrictions are at Alert Level 2. And as we have said, that resurgence support payment is now available on a three-weekly basis.
Supplementary. The Honourable Stuart Nash.
To the Minister, can he please advise if the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme, which is interest-free for 2 years, is available to businesses in the hospitality sector?
Mr Speaker, yes, I can confirm that the Small Business Cash Flow Scheme is open. It is also open to anybody who has already drawn down the funding and paid it back, or to those who haven't drawn down the full amount of funding and they can top up to that. It is a scheme that is still attracting a number of applications every week.
What does he say to the owners of the 1,000 restaurants that are reportedly about to close after doing everything that his government has asked of them? And does he think this sacrifice could be avoided with additional targeted support, not just more debt?
Mr Speaker, what I say to those businesses is that, as the government has done throughout the pandemic, we will continue to work with them. One of the things I do know is that when we saw similar predictions during the first lockdown, the actual result was that those businesses ended up busier than ever when New Zealand was at alert level one, to the point that the same organisation mentioned in the member's primary question was approaching us about the fact that they didn't have enough staff to meet the demand that was happening during alert level one. What the answer here is, Mr Speaker, is to make sure we continue to take the same response that the government has taken under the throughout the pandemic, which is that a strong public health response is the best one for the economy overall. Point of order, Mr Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable
Speaker. Can I ask you to reflect in terms of the earlier exchange that we had around the question and perhaps come back to me or to the House more broadly? You've previously ruled around the relationship between two parts of a question, and obviously the second part of this question is much wider than the first part of the question, and so I just ask you to reflect on what that might mean in terms of questions and supplementaries.
Speaking to the point of order, the Honourable Michael Wardhouse.
Just in your considerations of that, I think the second part of that question is based on a belief honestly held that the restaurant industry is directly affected by what goes on in the event industry. For example, a sold-out test at Eden Park would indeed fill the cafes and restaurants in Mount Eden. It is, I think, a direct nexus to the first part of the primary question.
Speaker. I would note for the member that the organisation is called the Restaurant Association, and my understanding about that organisation is it represents restaurants as opposed to retail and event sectors.
Well, I think the Minister of Finance is dancing on the head of a pin, and I feel no need to... Well, Thursday afternoon, Mr. Bridges and Mr. Brownlee, I understand your wish to get early planes, but we'll just leave it for now, shall we? I'll punish you by making you stay here. I'll go back to the Minister of Finance and tell him that I don't need any more time to reflect. My ruling stands.
Question number 7, Anna Lorke.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Agriculture. What recent support has the government provided for the agricultural sector?
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, the government continues to support the engine room of our economy as we build our recovery from COVID-19 and seek to position ourselves in high-value markets. Mr Speaker, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank
those people through the farming sectors who have worked right to keep our export revenue coming into this country. I recently announced further investments to support them through the Sustainable Food and Fibre Futures Fund. To date, the government has co-invested more than $150 million into 157 projects worth almost $299 million in total. It's a key part of government's Fit for a Better World, accelerating our economic potential roadmap. Mr Speaker, we've also announced funding of catchment groups with 171 now supported across New Zealand by the government, and we are supporting a total investment of almost $29 million. Thank you, Mr Speaker.
What are some of the recent projects being funded through the Sustainable Food and Fibre Futures Fund?
Mr Speaker, we're investing $6.68 million, for example, into a seven-year partnership with Beef and Lamb New Zealand, which is targeting a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions per kilogram of product produced. It's also expected to result in more efficient cows within the next 25 years through the use of artificial insemination and genomic selection to identify the bulls with the best genetic markers earlier in their life and with greater accuracy. Mr Speaker, we're also contributing $2.6 million to a $5 million project to develop a commercial-scale autonomous robotic asparagus harvester to help address the ongoing labour shortages in the asparagus industry and to support New Zealand asparagus growers to tap into high-value export markets.
How is the government engaging with the farmer sector in practical ways to help it restore waterways?
Mr Speaker, we have said that we want waterways restored within a generation, Mr Speaker. And to that end, last week I also announced the $2.1 million funding for 31 farmer-led catchment groups in the Lower North Island in the Rangitaki, Manawatu and Wairarapa. This enables growers, groups and farmers to employ catchment coordinators and farmers to develop farm environment plans to understand the environmental challenges and opportunities on their property, as well as helping farmers to produce nutrient budgets, calculate their agricultural greenhouse gas emissions, and understanding changing environmental regulations. Mr Speaker, it's through farmers working together in catchment groups and integrating the practical insights from them into their farm plans that we'll be able to shift the dial.
Question number 8, Chris Bishop.
Sorry, Mr Speaker. Thank you. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, what specific progress has been made with negotiations with Pfizer for COVID-19 booster shots, which the Director General of Health said over a month ago were, quote, at sort of a fairly crucial stage, end quote, and is New Zealand intending on ordering booster shots for the COVID-19 vaccine program?
Mr Speaker, to date, the Pfizer vaccine has been approved for two doses and MedSafe await data from Pfizer clinical trials before approving its use in additional doses. The Ministry of Health is in continual discussion with Pfizer and other pharmaceutical companies about New Zealand's future vaccine needs, and it continues to review all of the latest scientific evidence. Commercial conversations with the suppliers remain sensitive, and I won't be disclosing specific details.
Why were negotiations with Pfizer for booster shots at a critical stage over a month ago? Why have they not yet concluded?
Mr Speaker, in the context of commercial negotiations, you often reach particularly important points in the negotiations, and I imagine the Director General felt at that point that we were at a particularly important point in the discussions with Pfizer.
Right. Why has New Zealand not taken a no-regrets approach to ordering boosters? In other words, ordering as many as we possibly can, as quickly as we can, to give ourselves options in the event that we need them.
Mr Speaker, that is exactly what the New Zealand government has been doing around vaccines. That is why we continue to adopt a portfolio approach to vaccines, so that we have options based on what our future needs may be, so that we're not narrowing down too much and making decisions too prematurely about what might be best for New Zealand's needs in the future.
Will New Zealanders be at the front of the queue for booster shots if they are needed?
Mr. Speaker, it will depend on the nature of the booster shots needed, when they might be needed. I can say that from the conversations we've been having with Pfizer, I am confident that in the event that the evidence stacks up, supporting the need for a third shot of the Pfizer vaccine, we will be able to get access to that in a timely manner. But I also want to reiterate that we are not banking on that being the only option that New Zealand needs to have access to. We are in discussions with other pharmaceutical companies. Where agreements have been signed and it's appropriate to announce them, that's what we do.
What other companies... Is the government in discussions with companies other than those that we have advanced purchase agreements with for the four vaccines at the moment? And if so, what are those companies?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes. In answer to the second part of the question, those are commercial negotiations.
Question number nine, Jamie Strange.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Internal Affairs, and asks, how is the government encouraging young New Zealanders to make informed decisions online?
The Honourable Jan Tinetti.
Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to inform the House that the government's innovative and successful Keep It Real Online campaign is back, with the latest episode of the Eggplant series now available on TVNZ On Demand and YouTube. This latest episode is focused on tackling misinformation. Misinformation is often camouflaged to make it hard to tell what's real and what's not. It's a big issue for our young people, particularly at the moment when getting and sharing accurate information about COVID-19 vaccinations is so important. Equipping young people with the tools to determine fact from fiction has never been more critical. And Mr. Speaker, can I also recommend that to the members in this House?
Supplementary. Why was the theme of misinformation and disinformation chosen?
Mr. Speaker, we know that from the last nationwide lockdown that young Kiwis are spending more time online than ever. We also know from a report released by the Classification Office that 75% of New Zealanders surveyed thought false information about COVID-19 is an urgent and serious threat to New Zealand society. So it's really important that young people are getting and sharing reliable information about COVID-19 and vaccinations so they can make well-informed decisions. This latest episode is targeted to 13 to 18-year-olds and explores how easy it can be to take information at face value without checking the facts.
Supplementary. Why was the miniseries chosen as the format for the educational campaign?
The government recognises that traditional forms of public health and safety messages are not always the best way to reach our young people, and that we need to evolve with the times. The whole purpose of the Keep It Real Online campaign is to explore complex and sensitive issues in a way that young people find engaging and relatable. The focus on identifying false information in the latest episode takes a light-hearted approach to this serious subject and encourages young people to engage their critical thinking. Students from Rangitoto College and Manurewa High School were involved in the creation of this episode to ensure that the messages are understood and the storyline is engaging.
Question number 10, the Honourable David Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he agree with the Motor Industry Association that when combining fees under the Clean Car Discount with penalties under the Clean Car Standard, the price for light vehicles will need to increase on average by about 15 to 20% to offset the penalties? And what advice has he received on any likely increase in the price of light vehicles as a result of his policies?
The Honourable James Shaw.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, to the first part of the question, no. The fees and rebates under the Clean Car Discount are applied at the point of registration of the vehicle, so do not apply to importers and sellers. As the standard is based on the fleet of vehicles imported by importers, they can use a range of vehicles to achieve an average emission that meets the target. For example, this allows importers to sell electric and hybrid cars to offset higher emitting vehicles and achieve compliance.
In those instances, importers would not be subject to any penalty, and therefore it should not affect buyers. To the second part of the question, as I said to the previous transport spokesperson on the 29th of June on this very matter, I have received a range of advice on that matter, including, quote, a meta-analysis of CO2 standards in OECD and non-OECD countries suggests that they do not necessarily lead to noticeable price increases. The Ministry's projections expect the price of EVs and petrol hybrids to fall over the period. The risk of supply constraints and price rises is also mitigated by the design of the standard. Its design has been substantially modified from the standard that was consulted upon.
Supplementary, does he stand by Annex 1 of his Cabinet paper, Clean Car Discount Finalising Outstanding Decisions, which details that the car fees will be progressively phased in, so that in 2028, even a small car like a Suzuki Swift will be taxed?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
I'm going to ask the member to rephrase his question so it relates to either of the parts of the primary question or the answer that was given.
When the Minister said that he has received advice on the price impact on new cars that buyers will have when they purchase under these new rules, then does he stand by his Cabinet paper, which details that car fees will be progressively phased in so that in 2028 even a small car like a Suzuki Swift will be taxed?
No. No, advice given to a minister and ministers' cabinet papers are quite different things.
Yeah. Well, I'll try again then. Supplementary
right,
question.
But this is your next supplementary. You had one extra go. You know, it's not unfair if the member can't get it right. He's been a minister. He knows the difference between advice and cabinet papers.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse, and people over there will be quiet. Order. Mr. Brownlee, they made their comments before I called Mr. Woodhouse. You made them afterwards. Your breach is, if possible, worse than theirs. Mr. Woodhouse.
Mr. Speaker, it's very clear to anybody reading Cabinet papers that the recommendations are the Minister's, but the information that is contained in the annex that supports it is the advice that the Minister receives. I think we're dancing on the head of a definitional pin to say that that supplementary question is out of order.
Well, my view is that if the member was right, it would be the end of ministerial responsibility.
Well, speaking to that point...
I'm not going to have a debate. I'm going back to David Bennett.
Supplementary question. Can he confirm that if taxes are phased in on light vehicles, the Ministry of Transport modelling shows that only a 0.2% reduction in New Zealand's emissions in 2030?
Mr. Speaker, the combination of policies here are projected to reduce New Zealand's projected greenhouse gas emissions by over 5 million tonnes.
Supplementary question. Why won't he release a finalised fee schedule before the submissions begin on the Clean Vehicles Bill so that people know what vehicles will be taxed and when?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I understand that the submissions are important. We actually want to hear from the industry and other people who are involved.
He didn't answer the question. He said that submissions are important. I said, why wouldn't he release? He should surely answer that.
We'll ask the Minister to be more... to have an answer which relates more to the question about the release.
On behalf of the Minister, I'm actually unable to discuss the release without talking to the Minister, but the Government does want to hear from the industry. That's why we've got a full Select Committee hearing, and those issues will be canvassed at the Select Committee.
Question number 11, Glenn Bennett.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Customs and reads, what is Customs doing to facilitate trade and support New Zealand's economic recovery from COVID-19?
The Honourable Mika Whaitere.
Mr. Speaker, Customs is increasing trade opportunities and helping goods to flow more efficiently across the border, contributing to the economic recovery of New Zealand's economy from the impacts of COVID-19. internationally. Customs is advancing work to upgrade the Asian Australian New Zealand Free Trade Agreement and is contributing to new free trade agreements with the United Kingdom and the European Union. In June, a work plan towards a mutual recognition agreement with Thailand and the United Kingdom was agreed to, while work on a secure trade lane with Australia continues to progress. Mr Speaker, Customs has expanded its authorised economic operator program, the Secure Export Scheme, and made it easier for businesses to join, in particular Māori exporters. It has marketed the service so approved traders can benefit from certainty of supply chain and delivery timeframes. Customs continues to engage with small to medium-sized enterprises through its work on APEC 2021 to learn more about some of the challenges and opportunities these enterprises face as they navigate the COVID-19 environment and ways in which Customs Administration can support the economic growth of SMEs in the region. Supporting small to medium-sized enterprises is a valuable way of increasing the diversity of New Zealand's export base and encouraging economic growth in the regions.
Can I just say to the Minister that that answer was far too long? Glenn Bennett, supplementary question.
How is Customs supporting the import of critical supplies here in Aotearoa as well as overseas?
Mr Speaker, Customs is working closely with industry groups and other government agencies to ensure there are no delays in clearing critical supply chain goods, including the COVID-19 vaccine. Customs recently led work to deliver a set of best practice guidelines for customs administrations to support the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines in the APEC region. This was a great win not just for New Zealand but also the 21 member economies to ensure that COVID-19 vaccine and related goods flowed across borders as quickly and efficiently as possible.
How is Customs supporting New Zealand traders to navigate the impacts of COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, since the onset of COVID-19, Customs has negotiated repayment plans with 350 businesses on around $130 million worth of debt. Of that amount, only 30,000 remains outstanding. Customs has also lessened the load by allowing refunds of interest and penalties on repayment plans. Measures like these provide much needed breathing space, allowing affected businesses to pivot if needed and ultimately build back better.
Question number 12, Barbara Kruger.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question's to the Minister of Local Government. Does she stand by all of her statements and actions?
The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Yes. In particular, when I thank the Federated Farmers and Irrigation New Zealand for their involvement to ensure the workability of the Water Services Bill and to confirm that Taumata Arawai will work according to the scale, complexity and risk profile of drinking water supplies so that there are more appropriate responses for small and rural communities.
What is her response to LGNZ President Stuart Crosby's request to her and the Prime Minister with respect to Three Waters? Quote, there needs to be more time to work through the key outstanding issues before the current 8 weeks, end quote. Beyond the current 8 weeks, sorry, end quote.
Mr Speaker, my response to Stuart Crosby has been what it has always been. We will continue to work with local government to ensure that the water reform proposals that are being forwarded are done in partnership with the sector.
Will she pause or halt the Three Waters reforms, given Local Government New Zealand and numerous mayors, councils and communities across the country have called for her to do so, and if not, why not?
No. Pausing the conversation around the reform agenda will not change the scale, size or complexity of the challenge confronting councils. We've provided evidence and research that shows that the looming costs facing councils will be unbearable by ratepayers. We've also highlighted the need for councils to consider this seriously because once Taumata Arawai has stood up, higher drinking water standards and environmental standards are enforced, the several councils that are operating their wastewater treatment plants on expired consents will significantly bear the load of infrastructure investment.
Will she take to Cabinet any changes to the water entity model? If so, what will they be? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, I've given an undertaking to Local Government New Zealand that we will work with them and councils to understand the information they will have up until the 1st of October. At that point, I will present information to Cabinet and identify the range of issues that we can work on with the sector to address many of the challenges that they've identified during that period. I've given an indication in an earlier question of what those challenges are: governance arrangements, the way in which councils will work with iwi and their communities around the benefits of reform, and also the way in which an economic regulation will help deliver those benefits.
That concludes oral questions.